Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 400. There will be some special things being done to commemorate this, but stick around to the end of the video and you'll find out what they are. In any case, today, the questions are taken from lots of videos because it's a four regular Dry Dock month, and so I thought I'll use this as a catch-up month because we do fall back every time we do a Patreon Dry Dock. And so the questions this week are taken from guides 465 and 466 on the Buckley and Cannon class destroyer escorts, the Wednesday videos on destroyer development post-World War II and naval engineering building a battleship from keel to commission, and the Friday video on why geography hates the French, or why the channel kept England safe. So let's get on with questions. BK Zhang asks, many anti-submarine engagements involved ramming, but how common was it for the anti-submarine vessel to be mission killed as a result? It wasn't more common than not, but it wasn't surprisingly uncommon either. So if you performed a ram as a escort of some description, there was a greater than 50% chance you'd be some flavor of okay, but maybe, depending on the exact scenario, a 10, 20, 30% chance that you'd end up with a mission kill of your own ship. And that comes down to a number of factors. The speed of the collision, the relative size of the two vessels in question, and finally the nature of the collision. Speed is fairly obvious because obviously you hit going faster, that's more energy involved, that's more chance that your own ship is going to take a fair amount of damage. Doesn't really require a huge amount more than that. But relative size is also an issue because, of course, the enemy vessel, the submarine in this case, has a certain amount of inertia to it. Your ship has momentum. And when they clash, well, you know, something is going to break. So if you were, let's say, something a little bit larger, a frigate or a large destroyer escort or something like that, and you came across a coastal submarine, maybe something up to about the size of a Type 7, at that point, you outmass your target by 2-1, 3-1, possibly even 4-1 or more. If you're a 12, 1400 ton vessel and your target's a 200-300 ton coastal sub or something like that. And so when you hit the sub is more likely to be displaced than you are. Conversely, if you are HMNZS Moa or Kiwi, and you're coming up against a big Japanese submarine that outmasses you by 2 or 3 to 1, then obviously if you ram it, then there's a lot greater chance that you're the one who's going to take damage. And if you're about equal, then generally speaking, the trade is also going to be about equal, all other things considered. But of course, not all other things are equal. But it does make a certain amount of difference. So, you know, if you're a tiny escort attacking and ramming a big submarine, it's more dangerous for you than if you're a big escort ramming a small sub. Now, with that said, the final factor is probably the most important element, which is the type of collision. Because submarines obviously have an outside casing in World War II and then an inner pressure hull. The pressure hull is far stronger than the outer casing. The escorts, of course, generally speaking, are built without armor and generally speaking aren't built with particularly strong bows either. So if you have, for example, let's say a best case scenario where you're a frigate and you are doing a lot of tight maneuvering and you just about manage to get a ram in after a tight turn, so it's a low, relatively low speed collision against, let's say, a Type 7, and the Type 7 is partially awash because he's trying to dive to get out the way. At that point, you're going to probably chew a big chunk through his outer casing, which is probably more fragile than your bow, because even if the material thickness might be similar, your bow is obviously very wedge-shaped. The casing is just a big tube, or roughly speaking, a tube. And then most of your energy is expended doing that. Your bow gives the inner pressure hull a good old whack. You might end up with a dent or a bend, like you can see here on this French corvette. And the shock of the impact, just generally as a morale thing, but also in terms of starting small leaks and so forth, might be enough to make the enemy submarine decide it's going to surrender. So this is a good scenario, especially if perhaps the angle of the impact wasn't perpendicular, so it maybe carved off a section of the outer casing and broken a bunch of pipework. Not a huge amount of damage to you. Conversely, if you are a small corvette or sloop, and you go after something like a Type 9D or one of the many Japanese large submarines, and you hit it going at a reasonable clip, fairly perpendicular, there are two potential scenarios where you could end up mission killed in a bad way. One is just, you know, high-speed collision, breaks your bow open, opens up a bunch of flooding. You need to go and fix that. The other potential situation, which actually can apply to almost any escort against almost any sub, is if the sub has successfully managed to dive a little bit, i.e. it's got its hull below the water, but just not that much. Because at that point, and this can also happen in certain higher speed collisions as well, your vessel will ride up and over the submarine and either continue passing over it generally or potentially rolling the submarine as well. And as you continue onwards, you have a few things that are exposed underneath your escort vessel, including, very importantly, usually your ASDIC or sonar tends to stick out the bottom. That will not survive being scraped across a submarine's hull. And indeed, several times in various instances, ramming attempts would occur where the submarine would get underwater enough or would be high speed enough that the ship runs up and over it. And the collision was pretty impactful and usually sunk or forced the submarine to surrender. But it also potentially split hull plates, caused leaks, and ripped off the ship's sonar. And an escort vessel without sonar is not particularly useful, and thus it's a mission kill. Hank the Unobtrusive asks, how would the naval side of World War I have played out if it had started either 5 years earlier or 5 years later? How different would the balance of power be in the North Sea or Atlantic and the Mediterranean at those times? It's a lot easier to say 5 years earlier because obviously we know what the fleet strengths were. So 5 years earlier, so we're talking 1909 instead of 1914, I think things would have benefited the Royal Navy and the Allies generally considerably more because submarine technology, as I've mentioned before, developed very, very, very fast. The submarine fleets of 1909 are not the submarine fleets of 1914, and they, in turn, aren't the submarine fleets of 1916. The submarine in 1909 would have been a far less important weapon. There were fewer of them, and the ones that were around were far less capable. And thus, the more conventional surface warfare, which the Royal Navy would be configured to, obviously, win, would be far more important and would be also fought in a far more conventional manner. Also in 1909, the British have four dreadnoughts in service. They can obviously acquire a few of others that they have under construction as well. And the Germans don't have any until the latter half of 1909. And then they commission two in the very last quarter of 1909. So for the first year of the war, Britain would have at least one squadron, or at least a division of one squadron, possibly an entire battle division worth of dreadnoughts, and the Germans wouldn't. And obviously the pre-dreadnoughts then are the majority of the battle fleets on both sides, and Britain has considerably more of those, including a number of semi-dreadnoughts, which again the Germans don't really have. Now, of course, the interesting thing is that as time goes on, we go into 1910, 1911, 1912, you're going to see more and more dreadnoughts coming online. So the fleets are actually going to shift very dramatically in terms of their composition as time goes on. And also in terms of battle cruisers, the British will have three. Well, that two of the Invincibles will be ready at the very start of 1909, with Invincible herself commissioning a couple of months into 1909. The Germans have none and won't have any because for a while, because von der Ten doesn't historically commission until the tail end of 1910. And that's going to make a huge issue when it comes to fleet screens, because, well, three Invincibles can monster their way straight through any German fleet screen that's made up of armoured cruisers and small cruisers when the Germans have no real reply to it. 5 years later, so war breaking out in 1919, is a lot harder to determine because both the British and German naval building programs were curtailed very dramatically by the outbreak of World War I. So we don't know exactly what that would have looked like, what the fleets would have looked like by that point. So obviously Britain isn't going to have ships like Agincourt, Erin in Canada, but she is potentially going to have 6 Queen Elizabeths, 8 Revenges. The Renowns won't be in existence, at least precisely in the way that they do historically, because they will have been built as Revenge-class battleships. And then you've got all those intermediate ships, which the various sides may or may not have built. But all we could really say is that it will be a very, very much more modern war, because a lot of the older stuff that either gets dragged out or put through its last paces in the First World War, like pre-dreadnoughts and old armoured cruisers, by 1919, they're going to be long gone. And to be honest, by 1919, some of the older battleships and battlecruisers may be relegated to second-line duties. But then you'd be having a naval war fought with considerably more advanced equipment without the intervening battle experience of World War One. So it would be a very interesting fight, I think, with a lot of things going horribly wrong for both sides early on, as they come across scenarios that they just aren't equipped or trained to deal with. Redosaurus asks, was there any discussion about trading any of the casement guns on the Congos or Nagatos for turreted ones? Granted, it wouldn't have been done with the Fusos and the Iseis, but the Congos and Nagatos are built in a way where it seems possible. So with both of the Congos and the Nagatos, they suffer from a problem that a lot of World War One era capital ships had when it came to this kind of refit. And that is that the uppermost continuous deck, or mostly continuous deck, depending on the design, had casement-mounted guns already. As you can see here, this is Nagato 1945. Apologies for the smoke, it does obscure things, but it does kind of serve to illustrate the problem. And that meant that this upper section of the hull was stepped in from the rest of the hull, and that meant less deck space. Now, on the Congos, there was still a reasonable amount of open deck space in their original configuration as battlecruisers, as in because they were battlecruisers. And that meant that despite the stepping in and despite the additional superstructure that was added to them in the various refits during the 1930s, there was still just about enough open deck space that they did put some twin 5-inch guns up on top. Now, the reason they didn't go entirely for it is because, well, there wasn't that much deck space. And ultimately, if you take casement guns out from one level and you replace them with turreted or mounted guns the next level up, that has more impacts on stability. And generally speaking, unless you put virtually no protection on them, mounts or turrets above the deck will tend to weigh more, as well as having greater impacts on stability generally, than casement guns. And since they were fighting for every ton, then, well, it wasn't really an option. Nagato had a slightly more advanced problem. So switching over to this 3D model, you can see she had another row of casement guns in her upper superstructure, but you can see just how narrow the deck that was available, that was left above the lower tier of casement guns. And this is her in a somewhat later configuration, not her World War One configuration, as you just saw in the photo. This is sort of the World War II configuration. So there just wasn't the space. Even if you'd taken those casement guns out of the lower level, and even if you took all the casement guns out, the superstructure was still needed, so you couldn't cut that back really all that much. But the available deck space just wasn't sufficient to put anything on there, even if you wanted to. Now, the Queen Elizabeth class, for example, had the same kind of problem, which is why Warspite, even though she had a bunch of her casement guns removed, only has a relatively small fixed anti-aircraft battery. But on Queen Elizabeth and Valiant, they fixed this problem during the rebuild-reconstruction by not only stripping out the casement deck, but then building it out. So it's now flush with the rest of the hull, and that provides enough deck space to mount the 4.5-inch twins. So on Nagato, yes, you could put some, for example, twin 5-inch up there instead of the casement guns, but despite, obviously, the quite heavy refits that Nagato had to have anyway, you would have to have done an even more extensive refit on Nagato, where you did a Queen Elizabeth-style rip out that entire deck level, at least on the casement galleries, and rebuild it flush with the outer line of the hull, and that would buy you enough deck space, along with the removal of the upper casement guns, to put something in, but the Japanese don't seem to have ever contemplated that kind of scale of rebuild for Nagato. Or at least, even if they did, they didn't get around to it. Graham W. Kidd asks, why were 3-inch guns chosen for the destroyer escorts and not 4-inch, especially once the extra displacement was available in some of the designs? There were two main factors which are semi-related. Firstly, the US Navy had a ton of 3-inch guns available and the ability to produce more, and they were quite useful in a number of other circumstances as well. So sheer bounty, whereas if they were going to use 4-inch guns, they were going to be ripping them off of old 4-stack destroyers for the most part, which rather limited the supply. And a tangential portion of that is also the 3-inch gun is lighter, and therefore, you know, even if extra displacement is available, honestly, on a destroyer escort, you want more dedicated anti-aircraft weaponry if you're sending it out into the Pacific. And more generally, it's a destroyer escort, it's an anti-sub vessel. Therefore, if you've got a few tons to spare, more depth charges, more depth charge launchers, rather than fractionally bigger gun. The other main issue is usability. So I mentioned anti-aircraft armament already. The 3-inch gun had originally, or at least in the form it was in when it was installed in the destroyer escorts, been used as a anti-aircraft weapon. So the 3-inch gun actually has a very, very long history in the United States Navy, but the version that was being built and installed was primarily designed as an anti-aircraft weapon, which could also obviously be used in anti-surface roles, and to be perfectly honest, in an anti-surface role against submarines, it was perfectly fine. Yes, okay, maybe one or two submarines carried slightly bigger deck guns, but you could get more 3-inch guns on a destroyer escort, and of course with their high rate of fire, a destroyer escort versus a submarine in a gunfight was only ever going to end one way most of the time. The 4-inch gun, by contrast, as I said, last used on pretty much the 4-stackers and some of the 12-inch dreadnoughts that the US Navy had built, it had the big problem of, as it was designed, it only went up to about 20 degrees on its mounting. It was a surface action only weapon, and thus it would have been far inferior to the 3-inch because it's not a dual purpose weapon. Now, in theory, yes, you could design a new mounting with higher elevation and everything, but at that point, it's going to cost you time, it's going to cost you money, and it may or may not work because you don't know exactly how well the development process is going to go. Whereas with the 3-inch gun, you've got it, you already know that it works. And it's a similar thing to why you see so many 4-inch guns, ironically enough, being stuck on British ships, because for the British, the 4-inch was a dual-purpose weapon they had stupid amounts of already and could manufacture more of. Mariano Echeverri asks, in 1845, an English-French naval expedition forced its way past onto Paraguay at Vuelta de Obligado against the flow of the Parana River and against Argentine gun batteries. After having silenced the gun batteries, a certain commander had cut the iron chain that previously had been put across the river to stop their advance. I never completely understood how they cut a chain in a situation of an iron chain across the middle of water without a torch, but knowing that stud-link iron chains existed in that time, a recent discovery made during the river's extreme minimum levels of a type of chain that is presumed to be the chain made me wonder if it really was a standard type of chain in South America in 1845, because that could only have been achieved if the chain was imported from either the US, England, or France. So do you think the chain would have been a stud-linked one, or is it probably just a more modern chain lost from whatever ship? Given the amount of shipping and ship-like materials that were imported into South America at the time, I think it's entirely possible that stud-link chain would have been present and used in the battle. So I did a little bit more reading into the battle, and it seems that several chains were strung across the river, supported by either barges or boats, depending on the source, and to be honest, also depending on my ability to translate Spanish. And then they were cut. So the cutting itself almost certainly would have been done one of two ways, either with hacksaws, most likely, or possibly, considering that a lot of chain at that point is still made with brittle iron, just by hitting it really hard and shattering it, essentially. Now, in terms of is a long length of stud link anchor chain or similar found in the river the chain, it's possible. A lot of the barges were burnt to allow the ships to pass quickly, because then when they burnt, they sank and took the chain down with them. I can't speak precisely because I'm not an expert in every single make or model of chain ever produced. However, what I would note is that more modern chain tends to be what I call tic-tac shaped. So like you can see in this diagram, essentially the two sides are near enough parallel along the midsection, and then you have obviously the ends curving over. Most chain of the early 1800s, early to mid 1800s, at least most verified stud link type chain that I've seen, the outer portion of the chain tends to be more ovoid. So there is a continuous curve to it at varying angles of arc. So if the chain that they've pulled up looks very much like this picture, where you've got the two sides running in parallel for a significant time, then it's probably a more modern chain. Whereas if it's a more ovoid style of chain, then it's most likely older and therefore could potentially be the chain from that battle. Now, that's not obviously to say that all chain in that period didn't have parallel sides. There was certainly a certain amount of chain that did. But from what I've been able to see, most of this particular type of chain with the stud in between of that period tended to be more ovoid. Teflon Mark asks, were there any plans for new classes of export destroyers for smaller powers, the ABC countries, Sweden, Spain, etc., etc., in the immediate post-war period? Not really, unless it was very, very, very specifically asked for and a premium paid, simply because in the late 40s, early 50s, and so forth, some countries, like Sweden, were perfectly capable of producing their own new ships if they wanted to. But other countries, while a few, like, say, Brazil, did get some new destroyers to their specs built, the simple fact of the matter was that the US Navy, certainly, and to a lesser extent the Royal Navy, was offloading vast numbers of war-built vessels, or late 1930s-built vessels, a lot of them with surprisingly low mileage on the clock, as it were. So the US Navy had loads of destroyer escorts, and a lot of the earlier ones they weren't interested in keeping. And similarly, they had loads of destroyers. I mean, the US destroyer fleet post-World War II, once everything had settled down, you know, just the number of gearings that they'd built, let alone the stuff they were experimenting with later on, was far in excess of what the fleet theoretically actually needed. And so you had essentially near enough the entire Fletcher production run, plus most of the Sumners, that's above and beyond the destroyer escorts, which were surplus to requirements. Now, of course, a bunch of them were kept in reserve fleets. A few of them were kept around as active vessels for various purposes. But that still meant hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of low mileage vessels, which you'd already built, at which point it was easier, faster, and cheaper to just offer those to countries that wanted more modern destroyers, rather than go through all the rigmarole of trying to design something brand new in an era where budgets had been significantly cut. John E9999 asks, in your opinion, how much more potential for development in terms of power and or efficiency did conventionally fired steam propulsion plants have after World War II? Was there a lot, some, or not much? I think there was still a reasonable amount of development potential left in steam propulsion plants, if you take into account the average steam propulsion plant of the Second World War. The main takeaway lessons from it would have been that high pressure or higher pressure plants could be made to work, and also, thanks mostly to the Germans, how not to do high-pressure steam plants. And so going forward, higher-pressure still steam plants would be possible to develop. And I mean, you kind of see that the US Navy goes from 600 PSI to 800 to 1200 PSI, although there are a few cases where they probably regretted doing that. But it showed it definitely could be done. And The French, obviously, with the Richelieus, showed that forced circulation boilers could massively reduce the footprint and overall, therefore, space and weight taken up by your propulsion plant. And so if you combine those two things to have, say, a forced circulation 1200 or 1000 PSI boiler system, you could potentially get a much, much more efficient machinery plant than the average machinery plant of a World War II vessel. Plus, I think there could have been some experimenting with fuels. I mean, Bunker C is Bunker C. It's horrible stuff, but it's relatively speaking cheap. But even today, you know, ships of that era that still survive and go under steam have proven to be able to run with other kinds of fuels. Still hydrocarbons, obviously, but not the, hey, look, I can cut this into slices and serve it on toast in cold weather, Bunker C. Mitch M. asks, you mentioned the process of towing unfinished ships to Royal Dockyards for fitting out in the battleship construction video, and that it could be dangerous. Did the Royal Navy ever lose an uncompleted ship to an accident while towing to be fitted out? Not in the steam and steel era, as far as capital ships were concerned. And that was for a few reasons. Firstly, of course, it's a very expensive investment they've just made. So they would do things like, you know, look at the weather and try and work out, is the run that we're going to do from point A to point B going to be done in relatively safe weather? And if it looks like there's a storm coming, they just wouldn't take it out there. Secondly, because you are deadweight towing several tens of thousands of tons of ship, they also tended to put quite a lot of tugs with the vessel, more than was strictly necessary, simply in case the thing decided it was going off on its own little adventure and you needed to corral it back into position. Another factor was that sometimes, in fact, very often, the Royal Dockyards could either be in the same harbour or along the same river or in the same system as the private yard that had built the ship. So in some cases, it would just be a case of moving it along internal waterways or across a harbour. Of course, other times you would have to take it out by sea, and that's where there was more danger. The other factor that you have to consider, though, is that while, yes, you are talking about something that is a dead weight, as you can see here with Hood, while she's fitting out, these ships would not have things like their main gun turrets, or substantial parts of their superstructure, etc. And so they were both riding somewhat high. They had more buoyancy than they would have later in life, but also they lacked a lot of top weight, so they were more stable than they would be later in life. And therefore, they were fairly resilient, even if you did run into rough weather. Obviously, you ideally didn't want to run into rough weather, because then you'd be a bunch of tug captains trying to corral a 20, 30,000 ton lump of steel that had its own ideas about where it wanted to go. But because of the, even for the Royal Navy, relative rarity of these kinds of transport movements, they were pretty well planned. And as a result, no, there weren't any incomplete capital ships that just went ashore and foundered. Ships being scrapped, on the other hand, a fair number of those decided to go their own way. But in those cases, you know, they were far fewer tugs and a lot of other circumstances involved as well. Epsilon asks, you mentioned prohibiting foreigners from approaching dockyards while battleships were under construction and other similar methods that were used to prevent sabotage. What types of sabotage and espionage were done against ships currently under construction, and what were some key examples of sabotage, and what impacts did they have? So obviously sabotage and espionage are two fairly different things. In terms of espionage against ships currently under construction, just getting a decent view of them in the context of the yard that they were built in was often very useful, because a trained eye, especially if you could get photos, but even if you couldn't, could look at buildings and structures and so forth nearby and scale from that and estimate with a reasonable degree of accuracy what the size and displacement of the vessel was, and also therefore its length to beam ratio. And from that, a good naval architect could extrapolate things like its displacement, its potential speed, given its length to breadth ratio, you know, what kind of ship was it supposed to be? And as things went on and you would perhaps be able to see things like the barbettes going in, you could also work out how roughly how big they were and therefore what the likely armament of the vessel was going to be. Sabotage, on the other hand, is much more active, and it depends on who's doing the sabotage. So both by way of an example of what you could do and sabotage that was actually done, French and Dutch dockyard workers who were being forced to build ships for the Kriegsmarine in World War II had quite a few well-documented cases of sabotage, ranging from just being really slow and inefficient, and thus taking forever and a day to actually complete the ships that they were being asked to do, doing their work in a relatively sloppy manner that would require redoing it, which extended things even further, and in a few particularly memorable cases, actually taking material that had been gathered for the construction of ships and then essentially stealing it, putting it into the ship that they were building, and then sealing this material into things like the double bottom of a ship. So that would make the ship that they were building much less suitable for use, because obviously it has a bunch of movable dead weight it's not supposed to have in the bottom of the ship. Could also potentially damage the ship as it rattles around and gets bashed around in storms and so forth. But also those kinds of small bits of equipment, you know, brass and bronze fittings, radio equipment and stuff. This is stuff that is relatively expensive for its volume and would then need to be reordered. And well, yeah, you know, once it's been welded or riveted into the double bottom, no one's going to find it. So that's just lost, and people have to then obviously delay things and pay for even more spares to come in. But in a kind of foreign secret agent sneaks in to sabotage a shipyard, fire is pretty much the go-to. Because obviously in the age of sail, ships are made of wood, set fire to them, burn down, you don't have a ship anymore. And that's one of the reasons why setting fire to bits of a royal dockyard remained one of the few things which you could actually be executed for in the UK well into the latter part of the 20th century. Although there was only ever one execution for that, and that was a guy who tried to set fire to the rope storage area in Portsmouth back in the age of sail, because, of course, you know, rope was actually a very important tactical thing in the age of sail, because it was your rigging, it was your anchor lines, it was all sorts of things. So burning it all up, A, would delay and prevent fitting out of ships, B, probably destroy the rope walks as well, preventing you making new stuff very easily, and C, well, warehouse full of rope, if it goes up, can potentially spread because it's going to burn for quite a while. And even in the more modern period, like here with Hood up being under construction, as you can see with Hood, and look at pictures of Texas under construction as well, large amounts of wood were still in use to both provide scaffolding and to hold the ship in place. So if you were going to do, you know, get in the middle of the night, all sneaky, sneaky, if you could set fire to some of these support structures and get away with it, and the fire wasn't caught quickly enough, if it burnt and spread, then you could have the entire ship either structurally damaged or fall off of the slipway if enough of those supports gave way. Sharkman asks, I'm shocked they made such large models of the ships that they were building a standard procedure, this being the 1 to 48 scale models. Did they ever preserve these models? It seems like they'd make for a great museum piece. A lot of the time they were preserved. Sometimes the company that built the ship would keep the model around for their own purposes. Other times it would be gifted to an admiral or some other important person who was involved in the construction in some way, shape or form. And in some cases it would end up in museums, like this 1 to 48 scale model of King George V, which can be seen in the National Maritime Museum. So there are quite a few builders' models that are available to be seen in museums, but unfortunately with, to be fair, mostly the 2010s kiddification and reinterpretation, if I ever hear that word again, it'll be too soon, of various maritime museums, an awful lot of these models were moved out of the public display. Some were sold off and so forth, but many others were just put into back storage. So I say 2010s because at least in the 2020s, at the very least, the National Maritime Museum, which, you know, you'll remember back in the early part of the channel, I had a real go at for their extreme kiddification. They seem to have walked the back on that to a certain degree. So you do get some of their models out like this. But I still do remember with great fondness visiting the National Maritime Museum as a kid in the 90s and early 2000s. I was a teenager, but whatever, you get the idea. And wandering through entire halls that were just full of shipbuilders' models. Usually at 1 to 48, and they were so fascinating. They really should bring that back. Although, again, to be fair to them nowadays, while they've brought some of them back out again, you also will have a lot of them in storage. So if you are a researcher, you can phone up the museum and go, hey, have you got this ship's model? Or I see you've got this ship's model. I'd like to come and have a look at it, please. And then they can arrange for you to go and see it. So, for example, the builder's model of HMS Captain is not on display, but if you phone Royal Museums Greenwich and ask for access to their archive sites, they usually will be fairly nice about letting you go to actually see it. Mordred asks, could you comment on the Roman invasions of Britain in relation to the conditions you describe in the Channel? I know there wasn't an organised naval opposition which could have been mounted, but it would be interesting to know where they started from, if that's known. So lack of a naval opposition is a fairly important factor, because even if the Romans had sailed from Brest, they could have easily invaded England because, well, the whole thing of you sail west with the wind, the English fleet sails out, blocks the channel, then you sail east with the wind, and, well, they're waiting for you, doesn't apply if there isn't an enemy fleet to actually stop you. But also, you'll remember that when I was talking in that video, I mentioned specifically that it's really becomes an issue around the middle of the medieval period when you start to have deeper draft, larger hulled vessels. Now, while the Romans did have some large, deep draft, large hull vessels, a lot of their vessels were considerably shallower draft, and therefore, like with the early medieval period, the shallowness and of both French ports and the seas off of them didn't matter quite so much because, well, at the time, Gallic ports, I suppose, you could, you know, float any number of shallow draft vessels in those areas, which obviously helped quite a bit. Now, as far as where the Romans started out from, this is actually still a matter of debate amongst scholars, because while Caesar mentions where he left for his second expedition, he doesn't strictly say where he left for his first expedition, and nor is the primary port for the Claudian expedition actually mentioned. But based on the contextual clues and the naming and description of the port in the second of Caesar's expeditions, it's generally held that where the Romans set out from would have been somewhere, roughly speaking, between the modern ports of Bologna and Dunkirk. So on essentially the Calais Peninsula or the Calais Promontory. The problem is that the modern French coastline is not actually anything close to what the Gallic coastline would have been in the first century BC and AD. Specifically because, actually, funnily enough, given what I talked about in that video, the continuous silting up. So Saint-Omer, which these days is somewhat inland in France, at that point was a fairly significant port at the head of an estuary, and Calais and Dunkirk, which are now coastal ports, were actually islands in this swampy, marshy estuary of which Saint-Omer was the head. So it's entirely possible, and indeed some scholars have argued, that at least Caesar's, if not necessarily the Claudian expedition, but possibly them as well, would have actually sailed from what is now Saint-Omer, launching a large fleet into the estuary lagoon, and then proceeding outwards past the islands of what would later be Calais and Dunkirk. But it's not known, as I said, exactly where, only just the approximate area. And then over time, the continuous silt deposition, which I mentioned again in the video previously, has gradually filled in that estuary, although the whole area was still very marshy and much more difficult to access, even in the medieval period. It's only later on, as we get into sort of the middle of the last millennia and then the late part of it, that you get the land literally firming up. Elliot James asks, I made the mistake of watching one of those AI channels on World War II British carriers. They made a claim that the armoured flight decks, while saving the length of time in dock like the Americans had when they were hit by kamikazes, had longer-term effects on ship structure, which meant that the British carriers had shorter lives than the American carriers that were similarly hit. They seem to have compared Formidable and Indefatigable, both of which were scrapped in the early to mid-1950s, as compared to Essex, Hancock, Intrepid and Ticonderoga. So how much was due to damage and how much was due to post-war British disarmament? Yeah, you can tell when these AI channels are just doing their usual scraping, because you can tell what's happened there is they've essentially scraped one of the most commonly repeated and mostly incorrect myths about armoured carriers, which is that somehow having a kamikaze smash into the armoured flight deck did severe structural damage to a 23 to 25, or in the case of Indefatigable and Implacable, even larger ton carrier. You know, this is an aircraft that weighs a handful of tons. It's complete nonsense the minute you actually stop to think about it for more than 2 seconds. And indeed, as an engineer, the first time I read it, I just went, no, that's not how this works. You would get some deformation of structural beam elements in the hangar that are supporting the armored flight deck where that aircraft hit, obviously. That's just physics. But that does not translate through into the entire structure of the entire ship. Ships have undergone significantly more trauma than that without permanent structural deformation and issues. Now, there is a whole thing I could go into about why it's wrong, but for the sake of a dry dock answer, there were some structural issues with some of the British armoured carriers, particularly Formidable, which was scrapped fairly quickly. That was basically nothing to do with the kamikaze strikes, which, generally speaking, didn't have a huge amount of impact and were up top and okay, fine. They were much, much more to do with bomb hits, particularly bomb hits taken in the Mediterranean. And that's for a couple of main reasons. Firstly, the really big bomb hits could defeat even the armored carrier's flight deck protection and get a lot deeper into the ship and then explode and cause a lot of damage. You know, that's what bombs are designed to do. But also, while the carriers were repaired and put back into service, they were obviously repaired under wartime conditions, which meant do the absolute minimum as fast as possible that can get this carrier back on the front line as fast as humanly possible, as opposed to some of the American carriers which were hit, like, say, Franklin or Bunker Hill, which were essentially almost entirely rebuilt because, well, the US had plenty more carriers it could put out there in the interim. And to be honest, also, those two carriers were hit more towards the end of the war. So, you know, take as long as you need, almost. So, of course, if you've got a bunch of patched together repairs, that will have long-term implications on the longevity of your ship. But even with all that said, only Formidable was put aside quickly because of ongoing issues. And, you know, Illustrious, for example, she had to go home from the British Pacific Fleet somewhat early because of ongoing issues with patched up damage that was working loose again in 1945. But she was still around into the 50s. The single biggest problem with the Illustriouses was not accumulated damage, Formidable aside. It was either damage that occurred later on, like a severe hangar fire in the post-World War II period, combined with the fact that being treaty-built ships and designed to be armoured vessels, they were relatively small, both in terms of overall size. You know, the flight deck wasn't as long as it could have been if it had been designed a different way or without the restrictions. And the hangar deck was low. And that meant it didn't matter what material condition those carriers were in. They were on a very limited lifespan. You could have had a brand new mint-in-box Illustrious class freshly unwrapped in 1950, and it still wouldn't have been in service by 1960, simply because you couldn't fit the new era jets into a relatively low hangar height carrier like an Illustrious. And so you had to get rid of it, because there's no point in having an aircraft carrier where you can't fit the aircraft. Implacable and Indefatigable had basically the same issue. They had very low hangar heights. Now, they were larger carriers, and they could have been refitted to have a very nice, very generous, spacious single hangar instead of double hangars with low hangar heights. And indeed, there were plans to do so for them. Unfortunately, the complete, you know, debacle that was the refitting of Victorious ate the entire budget that was supposed to be for the refit of Victorious and Implacable and Indefatigable. And so, with Britain still a bit short of cash in the 50s, they just went, well, we don't have any money for them. And with the low hangar heights, despite their overall increased size, we still can't use the Indefatigables. So they're going off to the scrapyard because we don't want to or can't pay for the refit that would be necessary to give them a usable hangar. So it's almost entirely down to hangar height and the increasing size of Cold War aircraft. Al Sadius asks, if the English fleet based in Plymouth blocking the entrance to the channel is a big weakness for French fleets coming out from Brest, why not sail out of Brest and then hit the north side of the Cornwall Peninsula? I know there's some high ground there, but if they were to come to land perhaps closer to Bristol, then it seems like they'd avoid many of the issues you identified. So before I answer the question, I think I'll probably just preface it by a quick statement regarding the video as a whole, which is that I may or may not have made it clear enough that the kind of currents I was referring to in the channel that cause, you know, the silting of French ports and keep English ports relatively deep, and I described as generally moving kind of east-northeast up the channel, these are the underlying, essentially, seabed currents that and are a general trend over a long period of time. I wasn't talking about the tidal currents because, of course, the tidal currents on the surface, they go back and forth every few hours with the tides. Anyway, just thought that was important to note. Other than that, you can see here, this is the Spanish Armada heading towards the Plymouth area. Yeah, you don't go to the north side of the Cornwall Peninsula. It's just cliffs, 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 and more cliffs. Now, there are some really nice beaches there, surrounded by cliffs. It's just a terrible place to land. Plus, also, you'd end up in Cornwall. No disrespect to my Cornish friends and other people who live in Cornwall, but from a perspective of you are trying to invade England, winding up in the north of Cornwall is not a particularly good idea, because you are about as far as it's possible to be from London, which is your ultimate objective, while still being in the southern part of England. And that's not a good thing. I mean, even today, getting to Cornwall from the London area by car takes forever and a day. You can get considerably close to Cornwall, and that last little bit takes ages. And as I said, that's with modern motorised transport, let alone having to walk all the way. Plus, also, the Cornish people back then, I mean, and to this day as well, to be fair, but, you know, especially back then, were not to be messed with. So if you want to land your fleet in a small cove, perhaps with a really nice beach surrounded by cliffs, and then be attacked by the Cornish, good luck to you. They may even leave some traces for the rest of the army to find. But in more seriousness, if you go further up towards Bristol, then as you get into the mouth of the Severn Estuary, yes, there are actually some areas that would be pretty nice to land in and aren't surrounded by cliffs, which is nice enough. However, even if you land in that area, you face two problems, the landscape and the rivers. So firstly, the landscape, there is a continuous or near continuous ridge of high ground that makes defence fairly easy, that kind of starts off roughly west of Salisbury and heads roughly northeast towards St Albans. So there's a continuous line of defensible ground and defences, which you'd have to overcome, which would be quite annoying. Politically speaking, you're landing in the area just immediately south of the border with Wales, the Marcher Lords area. It's a fairly heavily militarised area. It's one of the areas that can probably mount a organised military response to you pretty darn quickly, especially if the Cornish have been going, hey, they're there, they're coming up there, they're coming up there, they're coming up there. By the time you get to land in the Bristol area, there will be a very large and heavily armed and angry response waiting for you on the beach that you're going to try and land on, which is probably not going to end very well for you. And even all that aside, you're basically going to have to march northeast to Oxford to try and cross the Thames so that you could come back down the north side of the Thames to get to London, which is almost entirely on the north side of the Thames at that stage in time. Yeah, you could burn Southwark down if you went on the south side, but nobody would really care, except for the brothels, which were most of the output of Southwark, apart from the tanneries in the medieval period. So you'd have to do a dogleg, and in order to do that, you're actually, from the Bristol area, doing a dogleg up to Oxford, presumably capturing Oxford, crossing at the ford and marching down to London. You'd actually be marching further past all these heavily defended areas than English armies would have to march if they were landing in the areas that, you know, Edward III and Henry V landed in when they were trying to march to Paris. From the area that Henry V landed in, Paris is just over 100 miles in a straight line, obviously a little bit more by marching. Bristol to Oxford and back down to London is 10, 15, 20% longer than that and involves fighting a contested river crossing. plus all those other defences and natural barriers I mentioned earlier. So yeah, it's really not a good idea. Ferrata Victrix asks, what naval campaigns, periods or conflicts would you recommend to people who want to explore less well-known but still interesting-important bits of naval history? I would definitely say 19th century South America. I know it's not something I've covered much on this channel, and that's in part because I've been doing a fair bit of research over the years into it, because it's not kind of the mainstream stuff that I grew up with. But it is genuinely interesting, and at least nowadays there's a reasonable amount of decent publications that have been written about the various conflicts in, well, English, obviously, from my perspective. As I said before, I can read Spanish, but realistically it's easier for me at least to read English. Now, as I've covered in a few other videos, it is sometimes a little bit dicey trying to figure out which sources, if you're going to read them in Spanish or in Brazil's case Portuguese, are reliable, because there are still some very heavily biased accounts in those languages. But that's why I also say, you know, perhaps look for the stuff in English, because there is a little bit of an academic filter. The most partisan stuff in Spanish or Portuguese doesn't tend to make it into the English translated world for the most part. But the reason I say it's very interesting is because whereas the 19th century, for the most part, outside of the Napoleonic Wars, generally consists of everybody going, what can we do to try and unseat the Royal Navy, and then mostly not doing it for the majority of the 19th century because they're too scared of them. In South America, you have different nations, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, at one point Bolivia, and various others, all vying for power, and it's a lot more even than the Royal Navy versus the other navies of Europe. And therefore, in some ways, the campaigns are actually a lot more interesting, because there are constant ups and downs, and suddenly one lot has an advantage, and then the other lot has an advantage, and then a third lot shows up out of nowhere. And so you get these coming and going conflicts which run through a period where, outside of South America and outside of a few places like the Battle of Lissa, you don't generally see a huge amount of conflict. So, for example, if you want to see ironclad on ironclad conflict in terms of individual battles, the War of the Pacific in the 1870s in South America is actually one of the best sources for looking at that kind of warfare. And there's classic small-scale Age of Sail actions earlier on as the various South American countries try to get independence. And it also gives you a much better idea of how and why the South American dreadnought race comes about, and the whole South American pre-dreadnought race that largely goes unrecorded. Another fun one, although there's not any individual major battle, as in, you know, a battle fleet action, would be the interventions on behalf of the White Russians by various European powers, primarily the British. But there's a lot of interesting low level, if you like, naval action between cruisers, destroyers, handfuls of small ships in the immediate aftermath of World War One, which again doesn't get talked about all that much. And the other thing, which I think is probably going to be one of my two major mini-series when I've cleared up the massive surfeit of miniseries I've got currently ongoing, would be the Anglo-Dutch Wars, because they are both genuinely interesting in that they don't get covered very much, but also genuinely interesting, again, similar to the South American situation, in that the overall is no one decided person or faction with a clear advantage. You know, the Dutch win some, the Dutch lose some, and therefore obviously the British win some and the British lose some. But as a result, it actually is, you know, especially if you're reading about it in detail for the first time, or at all for the first time, it is actually genuinely interesting. Whereas, I mean, the Napoleonic Wars are interesting, but from a naval perspective, when you come up against, you know, reading after action after action after battle after battle after battle, after a while, you go in the presupposition of, oh, how did the Royal Navy win this one? And when you occasionally run into one where the French or the Spanish or someone else win it, you're like, oh, that's surprising. Good on them. Whereas with the Anglo-Dutch Wars, you can go into full-on battles with 80, 100, 150 ships per side, and again, especially if you've not really looked at it before, you can go, I genuinely don't know who's going to win this one. I know who won the last one and the one before that, but that doesn't really have any bearing on who's going to win the next one, unless it's the Medway raid, because spoiler alert, the Dutch did win that one. Brian Smith asks, I know there were single and twin turrets with 5-inch and smaller guns. Were there any triple or quadruple turrets on destroyers or any other ships that used smaller guns as secondary batteries? If you go below 6-inch or 5.9-inch, then generally speaking, no, there aren't triple mountings, simply because the additional weight and complexity of those mountings at that kind of small scale where absolute rate of fire is vital either was just too big and heavy for smaller ships or on larger ships proved too complex. There were a few attempts to implement it. So, for example, during the interwar period when they developed the 5-inch 38, the US spent a fair bit of time investigating a triple 5-inch 38 mount before eventually settling on the twins and singles, basically because of those issues. But there was one particularly notorious small caliber triple mounting system, which is this one, the triple 4-inch, and that was most famously used, although not exclusively, on the battlecruisers Renown and Repulse, although obviously Renown had all of hers replaced when she got modernised. Suffice to say, it wasn't a great success. The general idea, of course, was that, well, 4-inch gun fires faster than 6-inch gun, and put three of them together, you can throw an awful lot of 4-inch shells downrange, and it, although obviously, as I said, it takes up more weight and space than a single or a twin, on something the size of a battlecruiser, it's the space that is more the issue. So two twin 4-inch would take up more deck space than one triple 4-inch, and three twin 4-inch would take up more deck space than two triples, and obviously that's for the same number of guns. So you can see kind of where the logic was coming from. Just put a massive number of 4-inch shells downrange and hopefully that'll swamp the destroyers. But it didn't really work out very well. And you can probably see why when you look at all these poor people queuing up behind to try and operate the thing, and everyone just got in each other's way. I mean, the mount was a little bit undersized, a little bit crowded, but to be perfectly honest, you could have made it 20% bigger and you still would have run into similar issues just because of the sheer amount of manpower you need to rapidly operate these smaller guns. And the minute you put a gun in the middle in a triple mounting, that particular gun crew has a very limited amount of working space and they're almost always going to interfere with the crews of the outer guns. Whereas if you've got a twin mounting, you have potentially some interference where the two guns are nearby each other. But obviously you have whatever wing space, if you like, the to the left and right of the guns, respectively, to just exist and move things around without interfering with the other gun. Brian Stevens asks, is there a captain or leader whom you would say stands out as the most successful at stopping piracy? Would Caesar be in the running? Honestly, that's one which I don't think I can really honestly answer, because when you look at the various anti-piracy leaders, yes, Caesar was extremely effective in exterminating the pirates who had captured him originally and the people in that area. However, when you look at things in the long term, although he wiped out those pirates, he didn't wipe out piracy in the Mediterranean. It took a very prolonged combined effort by lots of Roman naval vessels and commanders to suppress piracy, and even then they never entirely stopped it. And that's kind of the situation for a lot of other commanders as well. You'll have some commanders that fight very notable actions and perhaps take out individual very successful pirates. You'll have other commanders who perhaps never take out the preeminent pirate, but they do smash a whole load of smaller pirate fleets, which collectively for the average merchantman might make more of a difference, you know, rather than having to run a gamut of 30 pirates of varying competence. If you've only got to worry about one, well, he can only be in one place at one time, no matter how good he is. And then, of course, you've got to measure, I think, also overall long-term effectiveness, because if someone goes in and wipes out every single pirate in a given area, you'd think that's good. And objectively that is. However, if the follow-up to that is well, in a year or two, a whole bunch of other pirates from other areas had just moved in and the problem was back to square one as soon as that person left. It hasn't really stopped piracy. It stopped some pirates, but not the piracy issue. And between all of those factors, I think it's very difficult to pull any one person and say, right, this is the anti-piracy guy. With the exception, I would say occasionally, of weirdly enough, sometimes ex-pirates. So there were a number of ex-pirates through history who were given pardons or managed to earn themselves some form of pardon or exemption and then were turned on their former colleagues or competitors, obviously, in some cases. And they were very good at it because obviously they knew how pirates thought. So it was very easy for them to hunt down and destroy pirates. And between obviously their existing underworld contacts plus their effectiveness, they were often some of the better people at actually getting rid of pirates long term, because not only would they round up and destroy pirates very quickly, but they'd know where to look for a resurgence of the piracy issue and could, you know, especially if they'd been offered a governorship or something like that in the area, very often other pirates, having seen that just happen, wouldn't mess with them because these people were still around and they didn't want to end up like the last lot. Vinve asks, lately there's been talk about how Royal Navy ballistic missile subs are forced to do overly long patrols. But how long a cruise was considered too long during the period the channel covers, say during the Napoleonic Wars on one hand and perhaps World War II on the other? Are there examples of the kind of problems this caused back then? It's very much a moving target. So unfortunately, there's no kind of, well, if you're out for this long, it was too long. In both the Napoleonic Wars and World War II, though, generally when things were determined to be too long was more on account of the crew than the ship. So, especially in the age of sail, as I say, a lot of it depends on where exactly you're going. So, if, for example, you are sent to the Caribbean or the Africa station for anti-slavery patrols or whatever, if disease becomes rather rampant and diminishes the size and capability of the crew, then obviously once you get to a point where the ship can no longer really be operated because you don't have enough healthy men, that is too long. But that's a very sliding scale of how long exactly does that take, because exactly the same ship, say, cruising on the North America station may never run into that issue. And even with places like the Africa station, if you were lucky or your captain was particularly skilled, and in many other stations and places over the world, a lot of the time you'll see the ship being recalled because it is almost quite literally falling apart at the seams. So the ship has given up long before the crew did. Now, obviously, if you get sent to a really unpopular, disease-ridden posting under an unpopular captain, then your version of too long a cruise is going to be maybe a matter of weeks or months. If, on the other hand, you're under Pellew on the Indefatigable, merrily chasing around and capturing everything, flying a tricolour in sight, then as far as you're concerned, the longer you stay out, the better, because the more money you get. And hey, everyone's having fun, not many people are dying, and you're making a ton of money while doing so. With World War II, on the other hand, I mean, obviously there is the fuel limitations, but in terms of, at least we've sent you to, say, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, the Arctic, the Atlantic, etc. Again, the ship was very often the limiting factor. Machinery would start playing up and various other parts of the ship would start to fail, which would require the ship to come back for a refit. And that very often would break before the crew did. Again, assuming that morale wasn't a particularly severe issue at the time. There were, in World War II, also some cases of ships just accumulating damage and casualties. So any individual engagement may not necessarily kill or wound enough people to be considered a serious engagement, and might not damage enough equipment to be considered seriously debilitating, but it adds up over time. So, for example, one of the Australian heavy cruisers towards the end of the Pacific campaign ended up having to be sent back to home to refit and everything, simply because she'd accumulated so much damage from various kamikazes and other Japanese attack efforts. No individual attack could be considered crippling, but collectively they basically had stripped her of pretty much all anti-aircraft defense between equipment being damaged and anti-aircraft gunners being killed or wounded. Ran Pa asks, apart from hoping the United States would give up and seek peace, did Japan have a broader naval strategy prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor? And was there a particular naval strategist who most influenced this approach? Well, obviously the most direct and immediate influence was Admiral Yamamoto, because he was the one who refined the final strategy. But Japanese tactics did in fact have a broader naval strategy rather than just attack Pearl Harbor, hope the Americans give up, although that obviously was the primary hope. There were, you know, realistic considerations that they probably wouldn't give up. So the overall strategy had several layers, but essentially all revolved around that decisive battle doctrine. The idea was kind of like an outgrowth version of the original decisive battle doctrine, which obviously assumed that the US would just steam the Pacific Fleet over to the Western Pacific, and the Japanese would therefore be able to attack it and attrition it down into a smaller and more manageable force as they made their way there. Now, of course, that plan did remain in place if the Americans decided to rally whatever ships they had left and sail to confront the Japanese. Well, the attack on Pearl Harbor would have already done most of the attritional work, but they could always do more attritional work until the final big confrontation. But just in case they didn't do that, the main Japanese strategy was to take the resources or the resource-rich areas that they reckoned that they needed, and then take further islands, atolls, territory, etc., etc., with the idea of essentially creating layered buffer zones. And the idea of this was that then it would force American forces, and obviously later Allied forces, to fight their way through a series of strong points, and at each and every strong point, they would be made to pay a price, because of course the defenders have a natural advantage most of the time. And the hope was that either the sheer amount of casualties that they suffered would force a reconsideration, and the Americans would just go, look, we don't want to suffer this many casualties, let's come to some kind of arrangement on this. Or if the Americans were happy to suffer the individual casualties, then the alternate thing was that, well, if they're going to just sit there and take the casualties, that will again attrition down their forces until such point as the Japanese forces can corner them and destroy a majority of the American striking power, which in theory should again try and force the Americans to give up, or at least get rid of enough of the Americans' naval strength to allow the Japanese several more months or possibly years to further reinforce and build up their own fleet while the Americans go back to rebuild the US Navy for however many times they reckoned it would take to get them to give up. And finally for this week, the Weeaboo Terminator asks, can you rate each version of HMS Invincible based on how spectacularly they failed to be invincible? Okay, so the first HMS Invincible was a 74-gun third rate from the mid-1700s, originally the French L'Invincible, maybe? Anyway, she survived on the high seas for 17 years, 11 of them in Royal Navy service, before hitting a sandbank and sinking. So on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is very vincible and 10 is actually invincible, I would give her about a 3, maybe a 4. She didn't blow up. She didn't go down thanks to enemy action, but she was captured and then eventually sunk, didn't make it to the end of her service life. And well, at 17 years old, she wasn't even particularly old for a ship of the line at the time. But the lack of anything more dramatic than hit a sandbank after and most of her crew getting to safety means she's not going to score any lower than that. The next Invincible was another 74-gun ship of the line, this one built for the Royal Navy, and she had a slightly better life. She was involved in at least 4 major engagements, 3 of which were victories, although one of them was the Battle of the Chesapeake, aka the Battle of the Virginia Capes, the one that pretty much lost North America, or at least the 13 colonies, for the British, which obviously is not a brilliant achievement, but she wasn't specifically responsible for it. and she lost it about 40 years before also going aground and being wrecked, this time with somewhat higher crew casualties. Although on the basis of having fought in multiple battles, not been captured, I would probably give her a score of maybe a 6 or 6.5 out of 10. Again, you know, she did end up going down, and she was a participant at a major battle the Royal Navy actually lost. The next HMS Invincible, another 74 gunner, she lasted 54 years, which is a pretty good run, to be perfectly honest, for a ship of the line. She didn't do anything of any particular note, but that's because, well, by the time she was commissioned, the Napoleonic Wars were winding down. There weren't any major sea engagements at the end of that, and she essentially, like HMS Blenheim, bridged the gap between the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the beginning of the Ironclad era. She was actually broken up the year after Warrior was launched. So I would give her an 8 out of 10. She remained completely intact. She didn't sink. She didn't explode. Perfectly fine. The only reason she's not getting a 9 or a 10 is because, well, part of the reason for that is she was never really put in a position where she could potentially have exploded. Although, you know, decent seamanship kept her afloat, generally. The next Invincible, and then we've got two more after this one, was an Ironclad laid down 6 years after the previous one was broken up. And again, you know, not having had a huge amount to do, because no one really challenged the Ironclad Royal Navy for dominance, she lasted a fairly long time as well. She actually was around for about 44 years, give or take a little bit. She did take part in the bombardment of Alexandria, which is a well-known action, if not a particularly heavily contested one. And then in 1914, having been renamed because of the famous battlecruiser that was the next HMS Invincible, she was under tow to become an accommodation vessel when she sank and took some of her crew down with her, sank in a storm. So I would give her a 6 out of 10. You know, she had a good long life and, again, didn't explode, but, like a surprising number of Invincibles, did manage to sink due to weather. And then, of course, we come on to the famous Invincible whose last moments you can see here, the battlecruiser, and she's only around for, well, 6-7-ish years, depending on exactly how you measure things. But that's from commission date. And, of course, very famous for exploding. I'm not going to give her a 0 out of 10, though. I'm going to give her a 2 out of 10 on, well, two grounds. One, she gets a point for demonstrating her actual capabilities as designed against the East Asia Squadron down at the Battle of the Falkland Islands, which was, of course, a success. And she gets a second point because, of course, she initiated the battlecruiser race. So although she went down to, in some ways, her spiritual descendants, she was the cause for those ships existing in the first place. And yes, she was outmoded by them. But hey, isn't the whole job of descendants to try and outdo your ancestors? So I'll give her a point there. And then finally, we have the Invincible class light aircraft carrier of the time period after the Channel covers. And of course, famously, having been sold to Australia, but then rapidly recalled back to British service because the Argentinians had invaded the Falklands, she went out and fought down there. According to some Argentinians, she was sunk 3 or 4 times and magically respawned every single time. Either that, or we somehow magically had an aircraft carrier building, presumably a standard template construct machine or something, that was able to just churn out replacement Invincible class carriers every few weeks and also clone their entire crews, at which point I don't know how they thought they could win if we had that kind of technology. And then she went on to participate in various other actions in the 90s and early 2000s before being essentially put into reserve and then sold for scrap when the British government decided in their infinite wisdom that we could do without aircraft carriers for a while. But she didn't sink on her way to anywhere either, so she survived her entire lifetime, saw active combat, won active combat, trolled her enemies mercilessly by refusing to die, and helped to provide some of the impetus for various weapon systems developments, like close-in weapon systems and so forth, during the 1980s. So for that, I'm going to give the latest, or the most recent Invincible, a 10 out of 10. And some of you will have noticed that, well, with this episode, this is in fact Dry Dock episode 400. Huzzah, we made it. So in celebration of this arbitrary number, I'm happy to announce that the oft-delayed Drac sale of things is going to be live around about hopefully the time that this dry dock goes live. So you'll be able to find that on my website, drakinafell.co.uk. It's a wide variety of weird and wonderful stuff that can find new homes. Obviously, some of it naval related, some of it sci-fi related, etc., etc. Most of it available at what I think is pretty decent rates. You will, however, notice that there are three categories of the stuff available. One is a category of stuff that I'm quite happy to ship out anywhere in the world on standard shipping rates. That's not a problem. However, the other two categories are things that I can only ship in the UK because of certain shipping restrictions on things like lithium batteries and so forth, which internationally they don't like to ship. There's a smaller subset of that, which is there's a couple of items, fairly big items, which shipping is relatively implausible on, period. At which point either, well, you'd have to be in the UK or maybe in France or Belgium. And if you want to purchase it, obviously you can do so, but it would require working out some kind of specific, pretty much hand delivery or specialist courier shipping. You'll see why if you see those particular items. But I am happy to be that specialist courier within reason. So yeah, basically if you live in most of England, up to about Leeds-ish, most of Wales, etc. Bits of northern France and Belgium, I can make the journey myself. Otherwise, you have to kind of meet me halfway. But anyway, have a look, have fun. Hopefully, some of the stuff will be valuable to you. And if not, well, sorry. I can only give you so many opportunities to buy so many things. But as I say, hopefully it'll be good for some people. There is plenty of stuff I'll send internationally, and it's all hopefully fairly well priced. So yeah, that's my little celebration, giving a little bit back to everybody. And see you in another video soon. Bye for now.